You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome back to another edition of the City of Man podcast, a show where a conservative evangelical political theorist and a progressive one talk about political theory and the politics of the day. The conservative on the show is Coyle Neal, who is an assistant professor of political theory at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. I am the progressive, and my name is Edward Song, and I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Last week, Coyle and I gave ourselves and everyone else a little break from the humdrum of the presidential election to try to talk about the nature of the presidency itself, the powers that the executive branch possesses, and how that has changed over time. This week, we are jumping back into the presidential election itself by offering two episodes looking at the current presidential election and the kinds of considerations that might lead Christians to vote for either candidate. One of those episodes was with Nick Rodriguez, who is a policy expert in Washington, D.C., working on educational policy and government reform. Nick had an article on the Gospel Coalition website that received a lot of attention, in which he encouraged to vote for Hillary Clinton. But our guest in this episode is Rebecca Heinrichs. Rebecca holds a Master of Arts degree in National Security and Strategic Studies from the U.S. Naval War College, and is, among other things, a fellow at the Hudson Institute, where she writes about national security and specializes on issues of nuclear deterrence. She has provided briefings and support to several Republican candidates for president. Rebecca was also an advisor to Representative Trent Franks of Arizona on military matters and foreign policy. Her writings have appeared in a number of different outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Times, and Politico, and she is also a frequent guest on Fox News. But as with Nick, we are not going to be talking with Rebecca about her main area of expertise. Maybe we should get her on later on to sort of talk about that stuff, but rather about her decision to support Donald Trump's candidacy, which she has discussed as a commentator on Fox News, as well as in an article on the Federalist website entitled Five Reasons to Stop Kidding Yourself That Hillary is Better Than Donald, as well as in a few other outlets online. Rebecca is a member at Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., lives in Northern Virginia with her husband, Hans, and their three kids. Rebecca, we're really grateful that you're willing to join us on our show today.
Well, I am happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure.
We should ask, because we asked this for Nick, what's a little more of your biographical background? So how did you get interested in politics? And then if you can sort of briefly share sort of a quick overview of your testimony, just so we have sort of the credentials on both sides.
The short version. I'm from a very small town in the Midwest in Ohio.
Where in Ohio?
So north central, a little town called Fredericktown, about 1,100 people.
Sure. My wife's from Perrysburg.
Okay, yeah. Get out. No wonder she's so funny and smart.
there you go.
Small town, loved growing up there, great parents, Christian parents, two sisters. I grew up in a house where dissent was welcome, where the news was on every night, and my parents discussed current events with myself and my two sisters. And so we were sort of raised to be participating in this way. And by that time, I decided to go to college. I thought I was going to go to law school. Short of it is, I ended up going to Ashland University. The Ashbrook Scholar Program has a poli-sci program that sort of a classics, emphasizes the American founding and studying the classics in political philosophy. And that's, I ended up landing there and really started just absolutely loving political philosophy, really understanding the founding better. And my freshman year, 9/11 happened, and that sort of really made me more passionate about national security policy. Then I had internships every summer working on security policy in some way. I did have one at the Heritage Foundation, which I wasn't doing anything on national security policy, but I was still around others who were and, you know, doing conservative things. And then once I graduated from college, I just drove, I stuffed my car with everything I could fit in my car and drove out to DC looking for a job. And I had enough rent, I had enough money to last me 2 months at rent, and looked for a job and found a job on Capitol Hill. Working on the House Judiciary Committee, and the USA Patriot Act was my first bill that I worked on, and then went to grad school out here at the War College, and worked on Capitol Hill for a congressman doing national security policy and defense, and then met my husband on the Hill. He was working for a congressman on the Armed Services Committee, and I was lobbying him to support an amendment that I had written on for the bill. And we were married, and then once I had my daughter, our first child, I left the Hill to be at home full time. But then I just sort of hung an LLC, filed an LLC and hung a shingle on my door there, and said I would hire anybody who wanted my input on national security policy. I didn't know if anybody would bite, but I ended up. I've got clients now. I've got. I do writing and speaking on national security policy and research, and I do a lot of academic research on strategic policy and that sort of thing. So that's that. And then you had asked me what my testimony is. Raised by Christian parents, I'm thrilled to say that I don't really remember a time when I didn't believe in the Lord, I didn't love Christ, that I didn't understand myself to be a sinner in need of a Savior, and so I was very young when I remember just being conscious of the fact, praying that the Lord would save me, and being conscious of those realities about myself and my sin. So I was young, so I was at first grade when I became very aware of that. I had patches in my life where I was not walking with the Lord as I should. College, I sort of began questioning my faith. I thought evangelicals weren't smart. I thought they weren't serious. I thought they were making things up a lot in application in their sermons. And I thought they were going, I just thought that there wasn't a lot of anchor to their teaching.
All sadly valid criticisms.
So I took a long, hard look at the Catholic Church and really thought that I would possibly become Catholic. I went to Mass very regularly for several years, came out to Washington, D.C., and really felt like, I was really hungering for good preaching. I was really hungering for just good exegetical preaching. I'd never had it, but I was hungry for it. I didn't really know what I was hungry for, but that's what it was. And I was actually just jogging one morning on Capitol Hill and jogged by Capitol Hill Baptist Church. I had never even heard of Capitol Hill Baptist Church, and just popped in sweaty on my jog. And a guy by the name of Michael Lawrence was preaching and he hooked me. And I felt starved for the word, and I hung around, and then I left when everybody started shaking hands. I got out of there because I stunk, and went home and showered and came back next Sunday, and I've been going there ever since. And it was really Capitol Hill Baptist Church and sort of the Reformed, I don't want to call it movement, but school of thought and people there who really taught me what a healthy church was and what it really means to be held accountable in a church family. And so the Lord was very kind in that. And Hans, my husband, became a Christian under Mark Dever, our senior pastor's discipleship. And so we've been there ever since. So we've been incredibly blessed by the care and teaching of Capitol Hill Baptist Church.
There we go.
Great.
Well, Rebecca, I think we should start off with the question, and this is sort of a narrow question from a conservative perspective. So answering this for conservatives, why should I, as a conservative, vote for the pro-choice, pro-gay marriage, progressive, foul-mouthed, serial philanderer who contradicts himself every time he speaks?
What an excellent question. Thank you, Coyle, for that. First, I'd like to explain, I think that this this election season has been confusing to folks trying to understand what it even means to be conservative. So if I could just give it a little, short little 10-second explanation of why I consider myself a conservative.
Oh, sure.
You can take much more than 10 seconds, Rebecca.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, you know, I believe that our human beings' rights are from God. They're not from government. They come from God. It's what the founders believed. They put that in the Declaration of Independence. So that's, you know, that's sort of ground zero. Our rights come from God. Government is there to secure those rights. That's what the Constitution's for. That's what our laws are for, just merely to secure those rights, not to grant them, not to give them. And the way the United States of America has set up the government is that, you know, our ruler is the people. The people are sovereign. The people have decide how we're going to govern ourselves, and then we allow the government then to secure those rights and those laws that we decide. So that's what I mean whenever I say conservative. I want that. I want the ability to decide. I want the people to decide how the government secures their rights. So that's apart from any of my policy positions I hold, which I believe are secondary and a very, very far away from the primary purpose and how I understand our rights and the purpose of government. So why am I supporting Donald Trump then? Coyle sort of outlined some of the problems that we've seen with his personal character, his own personal past related to policy. But I think more what we've seen, what Donald Trump represents at this point in the election is really he's been a wrecking ball to what has become this progressive growth of government, the administrative state overregulation, in which the government is actually very detached from the people, and the government is enforcing what it believes is right for the country and its own agenda on the American people, apart from what the American people have agreed to. And that pertains to foreign policy, what we've been doing abroad. It pertains to immigration. That pertains to jobs, trade, etc. So there's been this enormous disconnect. Basically, the government sort of just hasn't responded well to the American consensus. So Donald Trump has sort of come in like a wrecking ball. He has blown through all of this, what has become bipartisan orthodoxy in a lot of ways, and has said, I'm not going to do what you all have said is required to be a government official. And that has been incredibly appealing to the Republican base on sort of a gut level. And so I think that that's actually necessary. I think what he's doing is actually good in that and sort of pushing back on this establishment that has really become oppressive to the American people. Some of his policy positions, you know, his big ones, the really big ones that I agree on, are one on foreign policy. And, you know, and my area of expertise is actually on foreign policy. And I've warmed up to Trump. It's taken me a long time because his style is so gruff and coarse and inarticulate sometimes. And so it's taken some time. But what he has said and done is, he has said the United States needs to have a more prudent foreign policy. We cannot intervene everywhere, nor can we have unrealistic expectations about what our military can do. And specifically, he called out Iraq. And when he did that during the primary, I think that that was when I started to realize, wow, if he gets away with bashing George W. Bush on Iraq and on how it's been a waste of American blood and toil, then he might win the nomination. And then, of course, he went on and did that. And we can talk a little bit more about that, too. But I think that there is a lot of good and refreshing aspects about what he's saying when it comes to international relations and war making in that regard. The second one is on immigration. a country is not a country if it doesn't have borders that it can enforce. That does not mean that I'm anti-immigration, nor do I think that Donald Trump is anti-immigration. I think Donald Trump wants to have control of our borders, which we don't have. And again, you've seen this, the progressive agenda or this progressive idea that, you know, that we should be open in all things to all people. And we've had a problem with the integrity of our borders, and because we've done such a poor job on assimilation, the character of the nation of the people is having a problem. We have pockets of people that haven't assimilated at all, and that's caused a problem for security, and of course just questions just their overall civic participation. So that's been good. And if I could say one last thing, and I'll let you ask the next question here. The third thing that he has done, and this is sort of on, you know, big picture, he is the law and order candidate. And I don't just mean policemen. I mean the courts as well. He wants the law to stand, the people to decide. The law stands, we enforce those laws. You don't like those laws, you change those laws. And so I think that's very, very good too. We're a nation of laws, not of men. So I think that's good. And then when it comes, the Supreme Court sort of goes under that in that bucket. He has agreed to appoint constitutionalists to the court. And so, you know, the next president is going to have a chance to appoint possibly four Supreme Court justices and dozens of federal judges. And so I certainly trust a man who at least professes to want to put constitutionalists on the court over somebody who has explicitly supported Supreme Court decisions that had activist decisions that went against the will and the consensus of the people. So how's that for a start?
Well, it's a start, and I guess I don't want to get too bogged down, like you said, in the policy things here, but I guess I would push back a little bit at least on the immigration issue.
Sure.
So I certainly agree that, you know, sovereignty and integrity of the borders and so on is important, and that's, I would assume, something that both progressives and conservatives can agree on, is that protecting the borders is sort of fundamentally a governmental role. But I would ask why you think it is that the man who promises to build a government large enough to successfully round up and deport 11 million people and build and maintain a wall 1,000 miles long is in favor of reducing the heavy foot of government.
Sure.
Like, that seems sort of contradictory to me.
So the government has only a certain obligations that the Constitution has just required of the government, and providing for the common defense is one of them, and we think of that as just sort of war fighting powers, but securing the border is certainly one of them. Now, Donald Trump has walked away from the deporting the 12 million people. I think it was, you know, one thing you have to understand about Donald Trump is, which I think all three of us here do understand this, is he's not a professional politician, and so a lot of times he's voicing sort of what intuitive to the everyday guy and gal of what they think needs to happen. And one of the things we've repeatedly heard is we need to get the people who are here illegally out. The problem with that, of course, is it's just not practically possible to go and round up the 12 million people and get them out. And he's walked back from that already. So, but I certainly believe that enforcing our borders is a governmental responsibility and authority. And I think that he can do that.
Well, that sort of leads in, I guess, to a second question. When you talked about the court, and that's one that I hear fairly often, is, you know, it's all about the court. Why on earth would you believe him when he says that he promises to nominate? And the list of nominees that he's provided are fine lists for the most part. My gut says he's nominating his sister, given the opportunity. Based on what we saw at the convention, I don't know that it's reasonable to conclude anything else. It'll be his sister, who's already a federal judge. So why, given how often he changes his opinion on stuff, you know, based on setting and who he's talking to and so on, why would you believe him about that?
A couple different points. One, George Bush tried to nominate Harriet Myers, too, and that didn't work out so well. So, you know, we have a two-party system, and Donald Trump isn't an island. He's not an island in the Republican Party, and he has got to play ball with Republicans. These are the people who he's going to have Paul Ryan as the Speaker of the House, and he's going to have to play ball there. If he wants to get some of what he wants to get done, he's going to have to do what Paul Ryan and Republicans want. They want. The Senate might flip. It might not. We might have Democrats in the Senate. I think that's actually probably likely. But he's going to have to, whoever he nominates, he's going to have to please the people who are working with him and playing ball. So, there's that. And you know, Donald Trump, he's put out two lists now. He's put out two lists. And I'm not one of these people who thinks we should have a litmus test. You know, how are these judges going to decide on these specific cases? Though I am incredibly anti-abortion and very pro-life. I think that what we need to see are constitutionalist judges and who will interpret the law and the Constitution as written and in the legacy in the light of Justice Scalia. And he has promised that. He's put out two lists. He has repeatedly promised that. And the thing about Donald Trump in this election, you know, he tweaks his answers. He might walk back on certain things, but on the really big ones in which he needs the support of the party to even get elected, he's been pretty consistent. And another thing about Donald Trump, you know, that we see as a character flaw, but it turns out in politics it can be a predictable way to tell where somebody's going to go, is he cares a lot about being liked. He cares a lot about his own people liking him, I should say, not necessarily the establishment and all that kind of stuff. But he really has liked the support of the people who he has earned. And so my gut says that he's probably going to have four Supreme Court judges, but he's going to have dozens and dozens of federal judges. And I believe that, you know, greater than 50% of them are going to be constitutionalists, probably a lot more than that, which is a lot more than we can say for Hillary Clinton, who has a long record of supporting progressivism, progressive policies, and supporting the decisions that have come out of SCOTUS in the last couple years that have been really bad on marriage and the family and conscience. So, you know, I think that it's safe to say that on those issues that Donald Trump is the safer and more reliable bet.
So, you know, when you outline those three issues, that's a very articulate defense of Trump's candidacy. And I could see, like, from how a conservative perspective, those issues of borders and defense and law and order, I guess, including the Constitution, why that's like very make him seem like a very appealing candidate. I guess in some ways, but I didn't necessarily recognize the candidate you were talking about when you were elaborating some of those things. So he certainly cares about borders, but to sort of suggest that he's not anti-immigration, sort of, that's a surprising thing to say about the candidate who sort of regularly said extremely xenophobic and sounding things about immigrants in the United States and the like.
Yeah, Donald Trump is anti-illegal immigration, and I would take issue. I don't think Donald Trump has been xenophobic at all. I think that what he wants is he wants to get control of the borders. He's serious about it. Now, lots of people say we want control over the borders, but then they push for things that, in fact, don't control the borders, and they advocate for things that just simply just don't. So, you know, I think, you know, broadly speaking, what Donald Trump is trying to do, he is trying, we have moved away. And I will say this too, Republicans have been bad on this too. As the whole country has sort of moved left on many things, the Republican Party has too. And when I say move left, I even mean sort of moved away from this idea of national sovereignty as far as international relations go, and the sovereignty of the American people in a lot of ways. So what he's trying to do is he's saying, we are a country. The United States of America has to care about us first, primarily, not disregard the rest of the world. But if we're going to survive as a republic, as originally intended, you have to control your geographic borders, and you also have to make sure that the culture and the mores of your people reflect something recognizable as American. And so he wants to have a prudent sort of policy on determining who we allow in the United States and how long they stay and for what purpose. And I think that that is actually completely in line with the founder's understanding of immigration. So, you know, and again, on policy, I mean, I know I can, Coyle probably has some other things he would like to talk about on some of his policy perspective, because I agree right away that Donald Trump has some policy things that he's recommending that are, in fact, just antithetical to conservatism. Eminent domain, I've got problems with that. You know, some of what he's arguing for is actually, I'm a free market conservative. It's contrary to the ideas of free market. But at least I know that with Donald Trump, at least compared to Hillary Clinton, we are going to have an opportunity to have a public discussion about some of this stuff. He is not actually going against the will of the American people, so he's sort of revitalizing democracy, if you will. I know that you don't hear very nice things about Donald Trump, but the amount of discourse and discussion about what's right and good and sort of challenging basic bipartisan orthodoxy in a lot of things has been good for the country. And so, you know, if he can do that, then I think that will be a good thing. And we conservatives have better roll up our sleeves and get busy, because there's going to be some things during a Trump administration that we're not going to like. And so we better, get to working hard at it again. But again, you know, there were candidates that I wanted to win, that didn't win the nomination. But part of what makes you a good candidate is your political savviness and your ability to have victory over your opponents. And so necessarily, we have seen that the other Republicans in the primary they didn't do it. They didn't tap into what the people wanted. And so this is what we have as the Republican nominee. And so I'm looking at the Republican nominee versus the Democrat nominee, and I see one that is not only one that I can tolerate voting for, but one that I think is actually the right vote in this election.
Of the two choices.
Of the two choices, certainly.
So something, and this wasn't on our list of questions, but it, as you were talking about some of the policy stuff, it sort of occurred to me. So feel free just to punt on it if you want to. One of the things that Ed and I have talked about in the past on the podcast is how so much of the sort of damage done to the country by the Obama administration, although Ed would not put it perhaps in quite those terms, is through the use of, executive tools within the executive branch, the various kinds of fiat at the president's
sure.
disposal, executive orders and signing statements and all things that are, the average American knows nothing about and many politicians know nothing about. Donald Trump is going into this office with zero knowledge of any kind of, executive office. Why would we expect him to be able to undo some of that damage if he has no clue how it works?
Well, we don't know. And I just readily accept that we don't know. I do know that Donald Trump, should he become president, is going to appoint some 8,000 political appointees in the executive branch. Those are going to be Republicans. At least most of them are. He might bring in some of his buddies from the private sector who might be just purely pragmatic business people who are not sort of policy people at heart in an ideological sense. But whoever is going, I try to tell people the way it works in this town, the president of the United States is one, again, he's not an island. He has to play with a team. And the team that Donald Trump is on is the team of the Republicans. And so you're going to fill out a White House and executive branch with Republican policy people. And I've seen his transition. I know some people working on his transition team. And of course, those are the groups of people who are working to put together his first days in office, what he would do, what he would undo, should he get elected. And these are wonderful conservatives who are there working and getting busy for that. So personnel is policy. Personnel is policy. So not only will the next president decide who our judges are going to be, at least who they're going to nominate, and then they have to go through the process, but they do get to decide who they're going to appoint in the executive branch. And I would certainly prefer to have conservatives there, Republicans, conservatives there, over the kinds of people that we saw in the Obama administration running the IRS and targeting conservatives and Tea Party members, and over the people who are there handing down these edicts on little boys and girls having to share bathrooms, et cetera, that are, simply just stampeding over the wills and the desires of the people. So you know, again, the next president, the next person elected is going to bring a whole team with them, a whole team. And so there, I think that, again, you know, one is clearly better than the other.
I guess sort of in addition to the whole policy thing, though, are questions of temperament, which are also a source of a lot of concern. So, you know, you had talked about national defense and national defense policy, for example, as being an area in which you saw that as being a particular strength. One great concern, of course, is that Trump has repeatedly shown a kind of inexorable temperament. Certainly in the realm of national security, he said really outrageous things about torture and the use of torture, about American soldiers torturing the families of terrorists. He's sort of said breezy things about our NATO commitments. He said laudatory things about oppressive leaders in other countries. I guess the national defense thing is like a specific question, but a little bit more generally, even if you saw in his candidacy particular policy proposals that you found to be attractive, the thing that's worrying about a lot of people is whether one just doesn't know what he's going to do. And he also has certainly had the tendency to say sort of really sort of outrageous, dangerous things that would threaten American security and its place in the world.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned several things.
Sorry. It's a general question about temperament.
That's okay. Well, I do want to address a couple of the specifics you mentioned actually aren't accurate. He didn't say he was going to torture family members of terrorists. What he and I don't have his exact quote in front of me, but the question was more along the lines of, you know, the rules of engagement of the United States has been that. Without getting into the weeds, the United States is very intentional, and we should be very intentional about not intentionally targeting civilians in war, of course. What the United States, though, has done is we've moved clear over to the other side, and President Bush was guilty of this, just like President Obama is as well, at going out of our way so far that we have actually protracted the wars and actually caused more deaths because of it, in sort of warning non-combatants, and specifically we do this in Syria, but we drop leaflets even when we know we're trying to target ISIS, and we've got folks working for ISIS that we're not sure are combatants, and we'll sort of warn them too, and so these guys who are working for ISIS are getting warned to leave, etc. So, you know, again, Donald Trump is pushing back on this notion that, you know, we're trying to fight this very gentle war. It's war without having casualties. Now, I regret the way he said it. I wish he hadn't said it that way. The United States should not ever target family members. But, of course, if there are family members who are helping and aiding and abetting enemies of the United States, they have then themselves become combatants themselves. I don't care if they're a woman or if they're a 16 or 17-year-old boy or man. If they're aiding and abetting the enemy, that therefore makes them an enemy of the United States, which is why I think it is important that the United States be more judicious about when we go to war, because war is terrible. And so you have to make these hard decisions. A wonderful man, Angelo Cudavilla, a professor out in the West Coast, affiliated with the Claremont Institute. I like the way he says, the United States should mind our own business and mind it hard. And what that means is, you know, when he's talking about war fighting, when we do decide to go to war, you go to war hard. You don't fight a protracted war for 20, 30 years and then never really have anything that you can call victorious. You have clearly defined military objectives. You pursue it. You end it. And you certainly don't have the ideas of democratizing a people who are simply unwilling and unfit to be democratized. And so I think that's what Trump represents. Now, his temperament specifically, I want to address this too. Donald Trump, he's tough. And I will say this on the NATO thing. When Donald Trump started talking about how NATO allies were not contributing what they were required to their own defense, that made a lot of people nervous. That made a lot of people in the Republican establishment and security circles nervous. It made the Democrats nervous. It made everybody nervous because that is, again, one of those sort of bipartisan orthodoxies. But you know what? Every single president has said, the last several presidents have said, NATO has to contribute more. What made people uncomfortable is that Trump said it in a way, and this goes back to temperament, that was believable. And what happened was, after that, I heard from my sources on Capitol Hill that they started receiving letters from our NATO allies reminding them, oh, by the way, the money is coming. We're committed to NATO. We love the United States, essentially, and we're going to pay more. We're going to do it. And so he sort of had, he's coming in as this businessman who's, he's coming in hard, and he's serious, and it's more credible and believable when he says some of the things that, that other people have been saying. And so in that regard, this hard temperament, I actually think has served us well. Now, this idea, you know, I hear this all the time that, that his temperament, though, Hillary Clinton likes to say a man who can be, so you can easily upset him on Twitter. So then how can we trust him with the nuclear codes? You know, you hear that a lot. Donald Trump is a man who's running an unnecessary war campaign. I don't think you're going to see him itching for war. I think it's hyperbolic to say that he's going to actually start a nuclear war, that he wants to start a nuclear war. He's going to get in office. He's going to have a lot of people around him who understand the way this works and the way our strategic policy works. And again, though, I do think after 8 years of Barack Obama, the world has become far more unstable, not because he's been this level-headed, it's been a matter of his own temperament in a lot of ways. Our enemies have not found him credible, and our allies have not found him credible when it comes to assurance, et cetera. So that, I think, has been a real weakness of the president. And so I think, it's about time that we have somebody who has a much more believable presence and temperament when it comes to, no, I'm here. I'm not kidding. I don't want to be ripped off. I don't want the American people to be ripped off. And I want everybody to participate in what we're doing abroad. And the gravy train is ended, allies. You know, we want you. We want your help. We don't want to go it alone. But this isn't free. Again, though, I it's not that I don't think... I do wish sometimes his tone was different, but I do think overall, I'm not overly concerned. I'm not overly concerned with his tough guy persona or his tough guy temperament that he's projecting on matters of international relations. I think we're due for it.
I will admit I was a little disappointed when the campaign put out that clarification, because initially I was like, yeah, finally, it's time to get out of NATO. The Soviet Union fell, 20, 25 years ago. We don't need to be in that anymore. And then they clarified and like, oh, no, it's just tough talk. So,
I do
isolationist in me rejoiced a little bit.
Well, I will say this, too. Coyle, it's not a bad point. I will say this, that, in George Washington's farewell address, I just gave a lecture to some undergraduate students on this who were really worried about Donald Trump and this. And we read George Washington's farewell address, and then it's like, oh, wow, we're supposed to be, we're supposed to really make sure we're not getting entangled in alliances that don't serve the purposes of the United States of America, and that we should be concerned about that. And so I am no isolationist. Anybody will tell you that I am, in fact, I'm pretty hawkish, and by hawkish I mean we should have a very strong defense that can protect the United States. It should be second to none. But that does not mean that we should be intervening everywhere at all times. It means that we should be able to protect our own interests, and it serves as a deterrent so that we don't actually have to go to war as often as we do. But I do think that's healthy. It is a healthy skepticism to have of NATO. It's a healthy skepticism to have of the United Nations. And certainly, if people aren't abiding by treaties, then there's no point in the United States being a member of those treaties. And so I think all of these things are healthy for a candidate of the presidency to be raising.
Well, for purposes of time, we should probably switch gears a little bit and ask, so coming at this now as a Christian, how do you interact with believers who have reached, the opposite political conclusion, especially, given how polarizing this election has been on the country?
Sure. So it's so funny. I'm, you know, out here in Washington, D.C., most of my Christian friends, I would say, are split between either supporting Donald Trump, but quietly and don't want to admit it, or they are voting for neither one, and or they're voting for a third candidate, or they're voting for their dad. But nobody, you know, it's I do know people. I do know Christians who are voting for Hillary Clinton. Of course, Nick Rodriguez, you know, I used to go to church together. You just had him on your show, made the case that Christians should be voting for Hillary Clinton. But I say a couple of different things. I say that Christians don't have the luxury not to participate. I say Christians have to participate in this election. I encourage them that obviously Christians say this sort of flippantly sometimes, but it's true, and we should preach it to ourselves that ultimately our hope is not in our leaders. You know, Psalm 146:3. Put not your trust in princes, in a son of man, in whom there is no salvation. And so, you know, as a Christian and, as it happens, a conservative, I mean, conservatives don't put all of our trust and hope in our government anyway. In fact, I expect them to mess it up most of the time, which is why I want fewer laws and regulations, and I want them to pretty much let the American people decide how they want to govern themselves. So I remind them that, you know, that we shouldn't be angsty. We shouldn't be angsty over this election. It's going to be fine. But you do have two choices. You have to pick. We're not – both of the candidates have very dubious backgrounds when it comes to basic character and virtue and morals. You know, every time somebody points out, oh, Hillary – you know, Donald Trump has had all of these affairs, you know, you don't like to bring up the mud. But when that's brought up, you can bring out the fact that – Hillary Clinton, of course, supposedly has been alleged by alleged victims of her husband, Bill Clinton, of his sexual assault, and she didn't come forward and defend those women. She didn't go and onto their defense and bring that up. In fact, there's evidence that she helped hide it and cover it, and not bring it to light in order to protect his career. Whether or not, I mean, that there's plenty of evidence that there's some truth to that. Hillary Clinton has lied on very serious matters. You know, of course, Benghazi is the most famous one. She has broken the law as it comes when it comes to protecting national security secrets with her email server. So when it comes to just sort of basic character, I think Donald Trump actually probably has a leg up, but I can understand when somebody can just say, no, actually, it's a draw. Okay, so you take that off the table. It doesn't mean that we have the luxury of sitting out this election. I think you have to look at both and you have to make a decision. I do want to say a couple of issues that I think are especially critical to the Christian in this election. Of course, I think, you know, back to being a conservative, if we don't have the right to determine our own laws, you know, then the whole thing is the whole experiment is over. Then, you know, the progressives and the liberals have won and we don't get to decide in what laws we have anyway. So getting back to why I think Donald Trump is good, go back to the courts. Hillary Clinton has promised, she's a Democrat. The Democratic platform this year, the platform, has said that on abortion specifically, that we will continue to stand, this is a quote, we will continue to stand up to Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood health centers, which provide critical health services to millions of people. We will continue to oppose and seek to overturn federal and state laws and policies that impede a woman's access to abortion, including by repealing the Hyde Amendment, end quote. So these are things that the American people have decided to slow abortion, to protect women, prevent dismemberment abortions, to make sure that young girls seeking an abortion have to have permission from their parents, et cetera. These are things that many pro-lifers have passed. Hillary Clinton has agreed to, by way of her party platform, to fight those. I think Christians should care about that. So forget Roe for a minute. And this is why I sort of wish Nick was on the show, because one of the arguments he made in his piece in defense of Hillary Clinton was that all of these pro-life bills and legislations might not actually end abortion. And how can you count on Donald Trump to end Roe v. Wade? And maybe abortion wouldn't go away even if we did end Roe v. Wade. And I'm here to say there are laws on the books right now that have been passed to protect babies from painful abortions, even if they don't end them, to limit them, to try to make sure abortion facilities are clean and follow state guidelines for healthcare facilities for women. And Hillary Clinton is here to undo those. And Donald Trump is not saying that. He's, in fact, opposed to that. He said he's opposed to that. And he's certainly not a progressive zealot or a liberal zealot that seeks to actually do that where Hillary Clinton is. So that's a big one. On religious liberty, I would say, again, Hillary Clinton has come out on the wrong side of religious expression. On the Little Sisters of the Poor case that came out, the Supreme Court decision, she was against the Little Sisters of the Poor. And so you see in Hillary Clinton somebody who has sided with the gay and lesbian transgender rights movement over Christians and religious expression. She even said at one point at one of her rallies that those who hold, Christians specifically, who hold policy that hold ideas that are contrary to the gay and lesbian rights movement are going to have to change what we think about these things. So I would argue that Hillary Clinton is hostile to the church, and the Democratic Party is hostile to the church. And you have in Donald Trump, if not a man of faith himself, he is certainly not out setting to determine that he's going to undo things that are important to Christians and that are important to the church. And so I think that this election is critically important to Christians for that. Those are the two big ones, and again, I just try to tell people too, in the end, I think it's Donald Trump is the right way to go. And again, we'll have four years, we can have another election. But given the two choices here, for the church and for the family, that I do think he is the better of the two options we have before us.
And so when you're talking to non-Christians who support Trump, how do you sort of pull for Trump while still distancing yourself from aspects of his campaign that you disagree with, particularly as a Christian?
That's a great question. So when I've talked to non-Christians, I have not been quiet about the things that he has said and done at his rallies that I have had a problem with. And, I think we sort of get in these corners where as soon as we pick somebody that we support, we can't see anything wrong with them. And then we only support, you only say wonderful things about them. I think it's important for Christians who are supporting Donald Trump to point out where they disagree. And so I do that when I am with those who are enthusiastic for Trump and who are not Christians. I do point out, I'm quick to make sure that they understand that I do care about the character of the president. And it does matter. But the United States has been in cultural decline for many, many years now. And so it's not surprising that that one of both of the major party candidates are not those of upstanding character and virtue that we wish to see in the leader of the free world. And I lament that. I wish that wasn't so, but I'm quick to point that out. And then I'm also quick to point out that, again, this is one of my the things that sort of excites me about this election, about the prospects of Donald Trump as president, because you've got a Paul Ryan and Senator Ben Sass and other Republican senators and Republican members of the House of Representatives that are not excited about him and who have an eye on him and who are strict constitutionalists themselves, you have a much better opportunity that he can actually be checked, even from members of his own party in the Congress, than what we've seen in the past. In the past, historically, you've got a Republican in the White House, the Republican Congress just rubber stamps it. I do not think that's going to happen with Donald Trump. And so I'm excited about the opportunity to actually see Congress exercise its own authority and power in possibly having a Donald Trump in the White House. And so I can encourage folks, too, that, you can be excited about Donald Trump. That doesn't mean you need to be excited about everything he has said and done. And we better watch for a Congress that's certainly willing to check him when he strays too far from what we understand to be truly constitutional and within his own executive powers.
So do you have we did not ask Nick this because I would assume he would go with the common wisdom here, but do you have a prediction for the election?
I really don't. And if I went back to Ohio, I'd probably get the feeling that Trump's going to win in a landslide, because when I go back home, you know, I was out here in D.C. and the Northern Virginia area, and I really didn't, this is during the primary, I didn't know any Trump supporters personally. And then I went home and thought, holy cow, my friends from high school, I had relatives that had only voted Democrat their whole life, and now they're voting for Trump, and Trump signs everywhere, and these are people, these are blue-collar people. I'm not from an upper-middle-class town. I'm a lower middle class town and blue collar town and farmers, and they all love Trump. And that kind of blew me away. So, you know, I think the momentum is with him. I think he needs to do a heck of a lot better in this next debate than he did in the first debate. There were too many missed opportunities, and he got too defensive about his finances. And so it's going to depend on his debate performance, I think, the next one, and just how he performs over the next, you know, several weeks. And then also the vice presidential debate is going to be important, too, I think. So I don't know. I think the momentum is with Trump, but Hillary Clinton has their traditional ground game to get votes out, and Trump doesn't have that. So I really don't know. I really don't know.
Well, thanks again to you, Rebecca, for coming on to the show with us. And thanks to everybody for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. To find out more information about our show and all the other shows in the Humanist Network, please visit christianhumanist.org. Coyle and I frequently continue discussions about episodes, as well as share interesting ideas that we have read on our Facebook page, which can be found at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Please go there and like the page. Please also leave us a review on iTunes, and you can email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.